Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and His kingdom. We're going to be focusing today most urgently on the latest developments in Ukraine, what has been happening there at the hands of Vladimir Putin and his invasion force, what the Ukrainians have managed to do to that invading force, and where things are likely to go from here. And we're thrilled to be joined by a very, very proficient and highly regarded expert on the Soviet Union and more recently Russia, who has taught for decades at the Army War College, has written extensively on the Kremlin and its masters under successive regimes, and who is, I think, regarded as truly one of the country's preeminent authorities on Vladimir Putin and the kind of agenda that he is manifesting in this incident and what his larger designs are on Europe and perhaps us as well. His name is Dr. Stephen Blank. We are thrilled to have him with us always. And let me just say as well that he is a senior fellow these days at the Foreign Policy Research Institute and very active contributor to the public policy debate there as well. Steve Blank, thank you very much for joining us, sir. Good to have you back.
It's my pleasure, Frank.
Let me ask you to just sort of level set for us, if you would, Steve. It's been about 5 weeks since Putin launched his invasion of Ukraine. Give us a sense of where things stand at the moment, and we'll talk then about where you think they're going to go from here.
At the moment, we are witnessing quite astonishing, actually, failure on the part of the Russians. I think that not only for me, but for my colleagues in the business, we are all taken aback at just how badly the Russian military and political leadership has performed here. They have not yet been able to hold on to more than maybe one or two, even moderately sized cities. The Ukrainian resistance has outplayed and outgunned them at almost every turn, despite a brutal and terroristic even strategy that the Russians have had to resort to because the first strategy failed. And as a result, the Ukrainians are performing better than anybody expected. In the area around Kyiv, which is the north of the country and the capital, the Ukrainians are actually now regaining ground because the Russians have pulled back several thousand soldiers from that front, which was going nowhere. The Ukrainians have thwarted their attempt to encircle Kyiv. They are fighting like tigers in Mariupol, which is still not surrendered despite being decimated by Russian artillery and airstrikes. The Ukrainians took back the airport at Kherson, which was integral to the Russian plans in the south of Ukraine as they came up from Crimea. And there's going to be a major battle in the southeast and east around Donetsk and Luhansk provinces, the Donbas, as it's called in the Western press. The Russians are going to try to encircle the Ukrainian army there. I'm not at all convinced they can, but the war is at a very intense stage right now.
When you look at all of that, Steve, and clearly the Russians have miscalculated how this was going to go, do you think Vladimir Putin is as surprised as many of the rest of us are at how this has played out so far?
I think he is. I mean, what we are hearing, and you know, most of the reports are saying this, that one, people have been arrested or placed under house arrest for failure, obviously, to brief Putin adequately, because he'll never admit to any mistakes on his part. Second, there is widespread dissension and finger pointing, to use the journalistic term, within the military and presumably the intelligence community over there as to who got it wrong and whose fault all this debacle is. We learned last night that military officers are deliberately misinforming Putin, who is quite isolated where he is, as to the progress of the war and what's really going on. We've had 7 or 8 Russian commanders killed. I think there's been at least one suicide, and he committed suicide because he found out that of the vehicles that he had under his control that he was supposed to deploy in combat, only 1 in 10 worked because of massive corruption. And that, you can be sure that's not confined to his regiment or battalion. So we've also had reports today, the head of British MI6, I believe, Sir Jeremy Fleming, gave a speech, which is a rare occurrence, where he said that Russian soldiers are sabotaging their own equipment, or they actually shot down one of their own planes, or are not following orders. We have at least one case where they tried to kill their own commanding officer.
So morale is in the tank, clearly.
Morale has been in the tank from the beginning, because they never told them that they're going to fight a war against Ukraine.
Right.
And many of these guys...
And logistics has been abysmal, and they found themselves up against a lot more opposition than they had expected.
Tactical disasters. They had this 40-mile convoy parked outside Kiev. I mean, that's you're asking for trouble.
Right.
And we have a video now of, you know, Ukrainians taking it apart, essentially.
Shooting fish in a barrel, as they say. Right. So let me ask you, Steve Blank, when you look at all of this, what do you think the prognosis is? Is this likely to see Putin doubling down, using even more of this massively destructive firepower that he has used in Mariupol, for example? And whether the Ukrainians are going to be able, nonetheless, to continue to tie them up and beat them, in fact, in the field.
I think the consensus of most of us, not all, most of the Western experts who are following this, and I should emphasize, I don't have any access to classified information. So, I mean, it's what I'm seeing in the journals and newspapers and on TV and so on. The Russians are going to double down to the extent that they can and try this encirclement operation against the forces in Donetsk and Luhansk, who are probably the most experienced Ukrainian fighters. They're going to continue this awful shelling of Ukrainian cities, but they're running out of ammunition. I mean, they're using precision-guided missiles, which don't work well. I mean, only 60% of them are finding their target, according to Western reports. And they're using hypersonics to take out buildings, which is ridiculous. And they're running out of ammo. And in some cases, we hear food and fuel, which, again, is absolutely astonishing. But I don't think that they can carry out a large-scale encirclement operation in the Donbas. They're going to do an awful lot of damage, and a lot of people will be killed. And this is quite tragic. But
yeah, it fits a pattern for Putin, does it not? Of sort of scorched earth strategy.
Scorched earth is actually when you're in retreat and you burn everything as you're in front of you. But it's a Russian military tradition. It goes back 500 years to depopulate enemy territories, deport, destroy, and then move Russians in. Now, they've done all this, but they're not having any success.
Sets up very nicely what I want to turn to with you next. We're going to have to take just a very short break with Dr. Stephen Blank returning on the other side of it to visit about, so is there something that Putin can do that might make a more decisive outcome possible as far as he's concerned. More destruction for sure, but also perhaps conducive to getting the terms that he is seeking from the Ukrainians and for that matter, from the West more generally, I suppose. We'll be talking about the nuclear option with Dr. Stephen Blank on the other side of this short break. Stay tuned.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. If freedom-loving people have the opportunity to write the history of our time, they will doubtless decry the immense help that American elites have given their country's mortal enemy, the Chinese Communist Party. By some estimates, Wall Street mavens like BlackRock CEO Larry Fink have transferred more than $3 trillion of U.S. investors' money, funds the CCP uses to wage unrestricted warfare against us. Tragically, we lost yesterday an influential financier who stood athwart such betrayal. Dan Celia was the longtime host of a hugely popular TV and radio program and ministry called Financial Issues. He was sharply critical of fellow capitalists who fail to put patriotism before profits. While we mourn Dan Celia's untimely passing, he is surely in a position now to enlist more directly the Lord's help in protecting the country he so dearly loved. Godspeed, our friend. This is Frank Gaffney.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're visiting with one of the country's preeminent authorities on the Kremlin and its master at the moment, Vladimir Putin. We're talking about the debacle that Putin and his army have encountered in Ukraine and what he might do now to seek, if he can, a decisive victory, having had that elude him rather substantially thus far. Steve Blank, you've studied closely the doctrine as well as the capabilities of the Russian military, and I think you've acknowledged being somewhat surprised at how their conventional forces have performed. A primary focus of effort, for sure, for Putin throughout his leadership era has been to build up, to modernize, to exercise, and otherwise doctrinally hold up the nuclear capabilities of his military. What's your current thinking about whether he believes that he can perhaps wrest a decisive victory out of all of this by the use of, at least presumably tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine?
Well, many people have written that they are concerned that the longer this goes on, the more the pressure will be on Putin to escalate the war because Putin cannot afford to lose. That was the consensus of the intelligence community also in their testimony to Congress. And that therefore he will escalate and use either tactical nukes or as the Russians call them, non-strategic. That is, they have a shorter range than ICBMs or submarine-launched ballistic missiles. They may also use what are called low-yield nuclear weapons, that the yield from the blast and the radiation is lower than in other cases. They have made a lot of rhetorical threats, not just Putin, but some other people obviously speaking in his name. They just overflew Sweden yesterday, incredibly risky and, I think, foolhardy operation with a plane carrying nuclear weapons on it into Swedish airspace. That was reported last night.
Well, so
Swedish time.
This whole idea of escalating to de-escalate, as he calls
it,
doctrine,
not escalating to de-escalate. Escalating in this case means dropping the bomb, actually. These are just threats, you know. Hi there, we have a nuclear bomb, if you haven't remembered, and we might use it. But let's come to the actual question of nuclear use. If Putin uses a nuclear bomb, let's say a tactical nuclear weapon, in Ukraine, he will bring the West into the war. I think he thinks that. I'm pretty certain he's been told that by authoritative sources, not just in Russia, but from the White House and other places like that. It's my belief as well that the West would then be much more galvanized to enter, although it may not be a nuclear response, but it would widen the war. And given what has happened to his conventional forces, he's in a worse position now than he was before vis-a-vis NATO. So I think that these are weapons that are being used to deter NATO. They are also being used as elements of information or psychological warfare, saying, I have nukes, so don't you do anything that would provoke me because I will use them. And I'm, you know, and we have all this speculation as to Putin's health and sanity, which, you know, none of us is able to gauge.
Yeah. This can't be ruled out. It can't be ruled in, I guess, as a factor is what you're saying.
Ruling it in means if they use it, this is an escalation that the war goes out of control.
Yeah. No, I was speaking about his sanity and paranoia and so on.
I don't want to get into that. Look,
no, I understand. We don't know, but it can't be ruled out as an issue here.
Yeah. No,
let me turn lastly, if I can,
Ukraine on this, but yeah.
Stephen Blank, let me just turn lastly to a question about running short of ammunition and perhaps the quality of ammunition, especially that he has prided himself on projecting as a key element of his claim to be the ruler of Russia. What does the relationship with Xi Jinping at the moment look like to you? And clearly the Chinese don't want to be embroiled in a fiasco in Ukraine. But on the other hand, are they helping to replenish Putin's stocks of ammunition or otherwise coming materially to his assistance, do you think?
Not yet. The Chinese appear to have had their own internal policy debate. But they have never wavered from their stance of, quote, neutrality in favor of Russia. And it's gotten stronger that they're in favor of Russia if you look at the meeting between their foreign ministers today in China. Moscow is appealing to them now, and this is quite amazing, for military assistance. Another sign that they're running out of weapons and equipment in general. I don't think the Chinese will give them anything that can be used in the way of lethal weaponry because they will suffer dramatic sanctions from the United States and Europe, which they don't want to have to undertake. They will support Moscow informationally. They will argue its case. They will support it politically and diplomatically. They will not, however, risk major economic assets that could be affected by U.S. sanctions, but they will seize opportunities where they can further extend their hold over the Russian economy and influence over Russian policy, particularly in energy, maybe military aid in the form of engines and things like that, but not actual lethal weapons. They will probably be able to extend their position in the Arctic with Russia, which needs to be kept under close scrutiny. They will also be able to get more Russian support on East Asian security issues because Russia now is quite dependent on China. So with regard to issues like Taiwan, South China Sea, Korea, and relations with Japan, Russia will be more firmly in China's corner than it has been. And it'll be interesting to see what happens with India because the Indians have leaned towards Russia as well because they are terrified that Russia would join up with China against them. And then since Russia is responsible for sells them 70% of their military weapons still.
That's a consideration. Let me ask you very quickly on that point. One of the things that they've done with the Russians is they've bought energy in rupees, and I think ultimately rubles, of course, something that Putin has responded to the sort of economic warfare that has been waged in retaliation for his invasion by the West. Talk about the economic dimensions of this very quickly, if you would, Dr. Blank, specifically the de-dollarization campaign that Putin has embarked upon and seemingly has a lot of support for from China.
Well, China has and Russia have for years talked about it and taken steps towards weakening the role of the dollar in international finance, because the strength of the dollar is a cornerstone of American power in world affairs. And they are attempting to attack that. Now, China is buying oil and gas from Russia and paying in rubles or yuan. The Indian deal is apparently a rupee-ruble exchange, but it's also at a 20% discount on price. So I don't know that it gets to be such a benefit for Russia, although anything they can get now, they'll take. They are trying to force Europe also to pay for energy in rubles, which would mean that in order to get rubles, they'd have to buy other Russian goods. By the way, this is Nazi Germany's policy.
It is. A lot of this is Nazi Germany's policy. I think it's fair to say.
It's a way of tying.
Stephen Blank, we have to leave it at that. We are hard out of time. I thank you for this update, and I hope that you'll come back to us very soon with further assessments of what is both happening on the ground in Ukraine and more broadly in the region, and of course, what it portends for the future. We deeply appreciate your expertise and look forward to talking with you again soon. Next up, we're going to speak about another military, our own. That is the topic that we'll be addressing with the great Elaine Donnelly.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. If freedom-loving people have the opportunity to write the history of our time, they will doubtless decry the immense help that American elites have given their country's mortal enemy, the Chinese Communist Party. By some estimates, Wall Street mavens like BlackRock CEO Larry Fink have transferred more than $3 trillion of U.S. investors' money, funds the CCP uses to wage unrestricted warfare against us. Tragically, we lost yesterday an influential financier who stood athwart such betrayal. Dan Celia was the longtime host of a hugely popular TV and radio program and ministry called Financial Issues. He was sharply critical of fellow capitalists who fail to put patriotism before profits. While we mourn Dan Celia's untimely passing, he is surely in a position now to enlist more directly the Lord's help in protecting the country he so dearly loved. Godspeed, our friend. This is Frank Gaffney. We're back. And I'm always very pleased to be able to say we're joined by Elaine Donnelly, one of my favorite people. She is also one of the most important figures, I think, in her work on behalf of our military, and specifically in providing sort of an advocacy for our men and women in uniform who really can't, under the military's, you know, instructions and code of conduct, speak for themselves about what is going on, well, at the hands of the Biden administration to the military. And it's always a real pleasure to speak with her, even if the news is often not that cheerful. Elaine Donnelly, welcome back. You run a marvelous organization, the Center for Military Readiness. You have for many years. You've been serving on presidential and departmental commissions, trying to make sense of what has been kind of one big social experiment with the military, notably with respect to women in combat and, you know, homosexuals serving openly and transgenders and the like. But I had a couple of things in particular that I was anxious to consult with you about. You had a very important piece recently about Ukraine and the differences that we've been seeing there, the necessary cultural differences at work there. Talk a little bit about that and how that bears on the challenges our military are facing today.
The article started with the Quinnipiac poll. A lot of people talked about it because it said that only 53% of Americans, if they were in the same situation as Ukraine under attack, that they would stay and fight. And 38% said they would leave the country. Well, that sounded alarming, but I sensed there was more to this poll than what was being said. And sure enough, there was. When you look at the internals of the poll and the differences between men and women, you find out that 70% of men said they would stay and fight, 40% of the women. Now, that is not a slam on the women, because the women are indeed serving their country in Ukraine, but not in identically the same way that the men are. What's interesting is there's no controversy about the fact that the men are taking their wives and their children to the trains, they're sending them away to safety, and then they turn right back to defend the country. Now, this is by order of the government, okay? But there's no controversy about it. When was the last time we saw a country, a whole country, showing respect for women and children in this way? Now, I think it's worth noticing, because the whole debate about draft our daughters, should we treat women exactly the same in time of war? No, we shouldn't. Because what we're seeing in the women in Ukraine, they are serving their country, they're making Molotov cocktails, they're talking to international media, and the men are going there to fight for their freedom and their country. And I just find that something that we shouldn't overlook, because it's a sign of civilization that perhaps we're not going to see too much longer.
It brings us to another topic that you've been focusing in on for years, Elaine, and that is this effort to treat men and women more or less the same in the United States military. Initially, we were told there were going to be different standards for performance, but they had to meet those standards and they wouldn't be dumbed down. Talk a little about what has actually been happening in practice that seems to mean that nobody's going to be meeting the standards that we need them to meet, and our war fighting and readiness, you know, performance is going to be affected as well.
Well, recently the Army announced that their Army Combat Fitness Test, ACFT, 3 years, actually four or more in the making, was not going to fulfill promises of gender neutrality in the standards. I've compiled all the promises that were made going back to 2013, 2015. We're going to have women in the combat arms, but don't worry. None of the standards will be changed. Women will have to meet the same standard as men. And oh, by the way, there won't be any quotas either to increase the numbers of women in the combat arms. Well, guess what? Reality intrudes. The Army has finally announced that they're going to have to follow one of two recommendations from the RAND Corporation. Now, RAND put it this way: you can have a greater number of women, but you're going to have to gender norm those standards. In other words, have women score differently, do different events, treat men and women differently. You can either do that, or you can keep the standards high and gender neutral, and you're going to lose a lot of women. Well, the Army decided diversity is more important, and they're going to take the first route. They're going to say, we'll have gender normed standards. Never mind that they have thrown overboard all the promises that were made back in 2015. And you know me, I'm not going to let them get away with this. This is all about the policymakers. It's not about women in the military or men. It certainly is not their fault. And I don't claim to speak for them either. All I'm saying is the policymakers are implementing policies that are harmful to both women and men, and they're doing it in ways that are weakening our military.
And thank God you are going to be taking this to the policymakers who are making these choices and doing so mostly, let's face it, out of the public eye, Elaine. So this is where your Center for Military Readiness does such invaluable work, exposing the rest of us to it. When you look at how this sorts out, then, there have long been different standards for men and women to the extent that women were not expected to do the same job as men. The problem arose when we were supposedly going to have them meeting the same standards that are required to perform in combat. And that was always going to be a very, very hard thing because they're not built the same way. They're not capable of performing the same heavy lifting and all the rest of it. So what you're saying is that they're now going to say, well, you know, when we promised you that we would make everybody fit to serve in combat, we actually lied. And we're not going to do that. And that has to have an impact on their ability to perform the mission. You know, for example, being able to lift an injured comrade out of harm's way in combat.
Right. That is one of the, there's six exercises in the Army Combat Fitness Test, and that's one of them, to simulate dragging a casualty to safety. Now, it's very appropriate that this new ACFT is going to be announced on, guess what, April Fool's Day. April Fool's, we were kidding. What do you mean gender-neutral standards? Well, you see, the Presidential Commission on which I served, we looked at this issue very carefully, and here's what we decided. In basic pre-commissioning and the entry-level jobs in the combat arms, you can have gender norm standards. You don't want to treat women and men the same because you'd lose a lot of good women in the military, and we need them. So what we said was it's okay to have gender norming in those early levels of training, provided that that training was not used to justify or qualify someone for the combat arms, and that means infantry, armor, special operations forces, and the like. Now that women are eligible for the combat arms and they decided to try this gender neutral social experiment, it's unworkable because the women's failure rates were so high. They started out, by the way, at 85% in the preliminary tests 3 years ago. Then they got them down, they tweaked it a little bit, and they said, well, we're not going to do that leg tuck thing where you have to pull yourself down or your knees up to a high bar. We'll do planks instead. Women and men can both do planks. And they made other tweaks as well. So the failure rate for the women wouldn't be as high. By the way, it's age normed also. Older soldiers were having a hard time. The problem is the failure rates are still there. And nothing less than Rand Corporation, the architect of all this, they have told the Army, look, this isn't going to work unless you do this or that. And the Army decided we'll do the gender norming. And this means, actually, they're doing two things. They are lowering the standard to a level that is equal for both men and women, but scored differently. And it's lower than it was before. For instance, if you wanted to qualify for the combat arms, you're a man, you had to do 30 of these push-ups, hand lift, special kind of push-up. Now it's down to 10. But it's equal for men and women, you see, and the scoring is still different for women and men. Now, this is going to be very interesting to see how it plays out, because the fiction of equality is gone, but they'll say, well, the failing rate is still the same, 60, 100%. 160, the scoring's different, but the final result will still be the same. 60 is the minimum level, and 100 is the top level.
Elaine, we're going to have to wrap this up.
But as much as they would be before.
Yeah. What alarms me, and I know you too, and you have said, studied this intensively for a long period of time and gone head to head with the RAND Corporation, which has been, pushing these, I think, misleading at best and downright deceptive propositions for years. We're going to have men who are less fit, as well as women who are simply not up to the job, and a military that is, as a result, going to be sorely pressed to be able to accomplish its missions of deterrence and winning the nation's wars, if, God forbid, we have to fight them. Elaine Donnelly, one of the things that we appreciate so much of your contributions to this program is you really do help us document the kind of war on the U.S. military that's taking place at the hands of the Biden administration, and we're going to have you back soon for a further update on all of this. In the meantime, I really appreciate what you've said in terms of bringing some of that corporate memory to bear so that we actually understand this is not an anomalous situation. What we're dealing with is the cumulative effects of many, many years of misbegotten ideas and I think some dangerous ones at that. Thank you for your time. Thanks for what you do at the Center for Military Readiness. Come back to us soon with more. Next up, we'll talk with Tommy Waller about the security of our grid and more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and we're joined by one of my colleagues at the Center for Security Policy, as you can tell. His name is Lieutenant Colonel Tommy Waller, United States Marine Corps Reserves. He is a force reconnaissance combat veteran with considerable and decorated service to our country in that role. He's joining us today in his civilian role, working as the senior director at the center's infrastructure security project. And I'm very proud of our association and delighted to have a chance to talk with him about how we're doing on providing protection for our infrastructure. Tommy, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Frank, thank you for giving me the opportunity to do this work. It's a calling, and it's super important right now.
It is super important, and I wanted to spend a minute or two talking about how some of the insights we talked earlier in the program with Dr. Stephen Blank about Ukraine, how some of the takeaways from what has been happening there has really powerfully reinforced the work that you've been doing, including leading our Secure the Grid coalition. Talk a bit about some of those takeaways, Tommy.
Yeah, so Frank, as you mentioned, in terms of lessons learned from Ukraine, I'm sure your viewers have seen so many of the news reports about the risks to the Ukrainian nuclear power plants. There are four in operation still, a fifth, Chernobyl, of course, was in the news. Chernobyl, as we both know, is no longer operating. But there was a significant concern in the media about the fact that that nuclear power plant, the offsite grid power, the electricity used to cool the spent nuclear fuel on site at the Chernobyl facility had been cut off, in fact, numerous times. So there was a concern about what could happen with that. In the Ukraine, thankfully, in Chernobyl, that nuclear fuel is so old that there's really little risk that it would boil the water off in those storage pools and cause the types of fires and radioactive releases that we're concerned about. But that's a lesson for us, Frank, because we have across this country 83,000 metric tons of spent nuclear fuel at 75 different sites, much of which is stored in these pools, these above ground pools, which require grid power to operate.
And the rods that are in those pools are hot, unlike the Chernobyl ones, and therefore you could really have a Fukushima-style problem. This is something that one of our colleagues, Tom Popick, brought to the attention of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, I think it was 11 years ago, Tommy. How is it that that problem hasn't been fixed before now? Is it that it's insoluble, or is there actually something that could be done, and why hasn't it been done?
Yeah, incredibly, Frank, the Foundation for Resilient Societies put in this, it's called a petition for rulemaking. They were petitioning the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC, to create rules for the industry to enable that offsite power, that, or to enable that backup power for the cooling of the nuclear spent fuel, to be done in such a way that doesn't require the current system, which is backup emergency diesel generators and diesel fuel, right? The NRC's current standard says that the industry only has to have 7 days worth of fuel for those backup generators. Those generators could go down. They're vulnerable to a number of threats, including electromagnetic pulse or directed energy weapons. So there's a significant risk there that if you lose that offsite power, the grid power, and then you lose the ability to generate power at the facility with, say, for example, a diesel generator, you could have a big problem. As you mentioned, Frank, that water could boil off of those very hot spent fuel rods. So this petition, what it said is to use existing technologies, which of which there are many. You've got solar power that can be used. You've got Rankine cycle engines, essentially a technology that can take the waste heat and generate electricity that can then use that can be used to power the pumps to pump that water. This is a problem that's solvable, Frank. They just need to exert the actual will to do it. There's been more than 100 different petitions to the NRC for various types of rules. They've only accepted two. Tom Popick and the Foundation's is one of those two, but it's time after 11 years that they actually take action on it.
Past time, I'd say. Tommy, President Biden has said very directly and explicitly that we should be anticipating a Russian cyber attack against the United States. How prepared are we, just from the point of view of this most critical of critical infrastructures, our electric grid, to contend with that kind of threat? Is it a real one as you see it? And what best we be doing about it?
Yeah, Frank, you're absolutely right. It is cyber. The cyber vulnerability is real and present to our grid. And in fact, President Biden said on March 21st that it's coming. That was his words. It's coming. And he was talking about a cyber attack from Russia on our critical infrastructures. The other thing that he said that day was that it's the industry that is responsible for deciding what protections that we have for that industry. And this applies to the grid, Frank. Although we have regulatory agencies like the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, it's really the industry that decides the protection standards. And when it comes to the specific threat of Russia and cyber warfare, we've known since really 2014 that there's malware in our grid, the same type of malware used to take down the Ukrainian grid back in 2015. It's present in our grid.
By the Russians.
And we've petitioned. What's that, Frank?
By the Russians.
Exactly, Russian malware in our grid. And we've petitioned the regulators, FERC, to create rules that the industry must detect and remove that malware. And yet they've taken no such action. In fact, it's so bad that back in 2019, in September, the former NSA Chief Information Officer, George Cotter, wrote to FERC and said that the fact that our grid hasn't been taken down via cyber from Russia is completely due to their own restraint and not the industry actually protecting that infrastructure.
Tommy, this is such an important point. We're going to return to it in just a minute after a very short break and talk a little bit further about what we can be doing about protecting our electric grid and, more generally, protecting our people and country against the sorts of threats that are now, I guess, a subject of restraint on the Russians' part and perhaps the Chinese as well, but we shouldn't be banking on it. We're going to talk more about that with Colonel Tommy Wallach right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and we are continuing a really important conversation with a distinguished military officer in the reserves. We're talking to him in his civilian capacity at the Center for Security Policy. Tommy Waller is his name. We're discussing the insights that we should have today, if not long before now, but certainly in light of what's been going on in Ukraine and the Russian practice of using energy as a weapon, to realize that we've got to get about the business of protecting our electric grid. And Tommy, you were talking a little bit about some things that could be done with the regulators, also with the utilities themselves. There's a so-called Align Act campaign I did want to mention before we turn to other things on this issue of these nuclear reactors, which if those ponds cool, quit cooling and cook off that water, you could have these fires that would spread radioactivity all over the country. Give us just a quick burst on what people can do to try to persuade the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to get off the dime.
Sure. Yeah, Frank, this is an area where people can actually make a difference. And in fact, at this point, we've had over 9,000 people do just that. And so what we have at securethegrid.com, that's the website for our Secure the Grid Coalition, if somebody visits that site, the first thing they'll see is a picture of a nuclear plant. And clicking on that will bring them to this, as you mentioned, Align Act campaign, where in a matter of 3 minutes, they're able to send a tailored email to their senators, their congressional representatives, and to the commissioners of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And that letter essentially says, hey, you need to act on this petition for rulemaking. You need to secure that backup power for that spent nuclear fuel. And so I'm happy to say, Frank, over in the last 2 weeks, like I said, we've had over 9,000 actions take place, and we can keep adding to it.
Good. We need many, many more, needless to say. Tommy, there's a new report by yourself and our colleague Kyle Scheidler just out about another thing that we ought to be doing, especially in light of what is being discussed by, among others, our colleague Steve Blank, namely the distinct possibility that a nuclear war might be in the offing if we're not careful here. The Russians have that capacity. What they've also done that unfortunately may make such a war more likely is they've gone to great lengths to protect at least key parts of their populations against such a war's effects. Where are we on civil defense at this point, Tommy?
Frank, I'm sorry to say that civil defense has essentially evaporated over the past few decades. It's been completely replaced by the current FEMA mindset, which is that people need to only be prepared for 72 hours. There's this assumption across the country that there's going to be some cavalry coming to the rescue if we were in a situation where, for example, we lost our grid in a particular state or region. There is no cavalry coming. I can assure you that. And unfortunately, what that means is that individuals, families, and communities, their own safety and survival is going to be up to them. And so the level at which they are prepared for an impending crisis is going to make all the difference in the world with respect to just how well they make it, right? You mentioned Ukraine. Frank, we see right now where, you know, there are teenagers with 3 days of training being pressed into a war, right? And that war could expand, and that Russia, as we talked about, could hurt us here via cyber or nuclear. They could bring that fight home to our country in an immediate fashion. And unfortunately, we're not at all prepared. And so we did, Frank, we just published today a new report, Bring Back Civil Defense, which chronicles how we lost this mindset, this civil defense mindset, and some of the things that can be done to resurrect it.
Terrific. Tommy, I can't think of a more important mission at the moment than taking care of our critical infrastructure and taking care of our people so that if, God forbid, somebody does think a nuclear war can be fought and won, that we have created to the maximum degree we can the capabilities to survive it and show that they're wrong about that. One other piece of this defensive posture that I think really behooves us to make sure we're talking about as well, Tommy, is missile defense. One of our distinguished colleagues, of course, is Ambassador Hank Cooper, who was the director of the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization under President George H.W. Bush. Where are we on being able to protect ourselves against missile attack in this country? And if it's not up to scratch, what does need to be done now?
Yeah, again, Frank, I hate to say it, but we're not in a good spot. You know, there's a concept, I know you've had Dr. Peter Pry on the show before, that he's come up with to replace the mutually assured destruction concept, or MAD, which is SANE, strategic assured national existence. And missile defense has to be a part of that. You and I both know that the quickest and easiest way for Russia or any other adversary to take down our electric grid, the most catastrophic way, is through a nuclear electromagnetic pulse attack. And of course, that would most likely take place with a ballistic missile. In fact, that's exactly what the Russians warned us against during the Kosovo crisis. You may remember when our congressional delegation went there and met with Russian leaders who were upset with the United States at that time. That's when they first mentioned the prospect of attacking the United States with a submarine-launched ballistic missile to turn our lights off. It's really what started the whole conversation in the unclassified realm of nuclear EMP. So one of the best ways to prevent such a nuclear EMP catastrophe would be for us to be able to shoot down these ballistic missiles. And the best, cheapest, and most effective way would be to do it from space. And so I am privileged to be part of this network of people, yourself preeminent among them, Ambassador Cooper as well, who's called for space-based ballistic missile defense.
Tommy, you're really at the vanguard of this effort, and we'd so appreciate your time, and I hope you'll come back to us with updates on all of this really vitally important work. Keep it up, my friend. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Again, Monday, same time, same station. Securing America, we appreciate your visits and hope that you are finding in each of these conversations what you can do to help securing America. And if you are interested in more, please check out a wonderful resource, both the Center for Security Policy sites and securingamerica.tv, and then go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.